Welcome to the Freedom Trail Podcast, brought to you by the Freedom Trail Foundation and the Massachusetts Teachers Association. Episode 4, The Battle of Bunker Hill, featuring The Whites of Their Eyes, an audio play by Sam Jones, performed by the Freedom Trail Players. Then, an interview with William Fowler, Distinguished Professor of History at Northeastern University, on the details of the battle. Part 1, The Whites of Their Eyes.
It is certainly true that any study of history frequently leads to the discovery that much of what the student thought they knew was colored by folklore and half-truths. Rarely is this more true than in the study of the Battle of Bunker Hill. One of the most well-known of little-known truths in American history is that the Battle of Bunker Hill was not fought on Bunker Hill at all, or Bunker's Hill, as it was more frequently called in the 18th century, but in fact was fought on Breed's Hill. In the American mind, the Battle of Bunker Hill is inextricably linked with the phrase, "Don't fire until you see the whites of their eyes," a command given that day to American militiamen whose lack of ammunition put them at a disadvantage against the redcoats marching against them. In the minds of most Americans, this is an original American sentiment, a perfect expression of the determination of Americans to stand against a better trained and better equipped army with grit and determination. The narrative of the American Revolution condensed into a single sentence. The earliest attribution of the words to an American is believed to come from Mason Weems' Life of George Washington, with curious anecdotes equally honorable to himself and exemplary to his young countrymen. The 1808 edition places them in the mouth of Commanding General Israel Putnam.
"Don't throw away a single shot, my brave fellows. Don't throw away a single shot, but take good aim. Nor touch a trigger till you see the whites of their eyes."
Stirring words indeed, but the knowing reader will hesitate over an attribution from Weems, whose book gave us the immortal but dubious tale of Washington and the cherry tree, and is referred to by historian J. L. Bell as a great font of American myth. Samuel Swett's History of the Battle of Bunker Hill, published in 1818, included a different retelling of Putnam's speech.
"Powder must not be wasted. Do not fire at the enemy until you see the whites of their eyes, and then fire low. Aim at their waistbands. You are all marksmen and can kill a squirrel at 100 yards. Reserve your fire, and the enemy will all be destroyed. Aim at the handsome coats. Pick off the commanders."
Swett quoted testimony from 3 veterans of the battle, and all 3 said that Putnam said "the whites of their eyes," or at least that the officers who they did hear say it said the orders came from Putnam. Swett's account said, "The same orders were reiterated by Prescott at the redoubt, by Pomeroy, Stark, and all the veteran officers." This account of multiple officers giving the same order added fuel to the fire of a debate over correctly identifying the ranking commander as the 50th anniversary of the battle approached, some choosing to attribute the quote to Putnam's main rival in that debate, Colonel William Prescott. Imagine the consternation which must have occurred when Thomas Carlyle's History of Frederick II of Prussia, called Frederick the Great, was published in 1858, and revealed those cherished words that most Americans no doubt believe were spoken for the first time that fateful day, may have been spoken as much as 30 years earlier by a German margrave. On May 22, 1745, cutting through the Austrian army while retiring from Jagendorf, one Margrave Karl was quoted by Carlyle as giving the order,
"Silent, until you see the whites of their eyes."
"Jawohl, mein Herr."
"Silent."
"Jawohl, mein Herr."
"Wunderbar."
Not to be outdone, the Scots have a claim detailed in William Anderson's book, The Scottish Nation, or The Surnames, Families, Literature, Honors, and Biographical History of the People of Scotland, Volume 2, published in 1863. At the Battle of Dettington, June 14, 1743, Scottish Lord Sir Andrew Agnew was ordered with his regiment, the Scots Fusiliers, to guard a pass at the extremity of the British Army's position. As his men were preparing for dinner, he was informed of the approach of a body of the enemy's cavalry.
"The loons will never have the impudence to attack the Scots Fusiliers. Let's have dinner, lads. You'll fight the better for it."
Sir Andrew altered his opinion when a French bullet shot the chicken bone out of his hand.
"Ach, they shot me dinner! They must be in earnest now. All right, lads, open up a hole in the line and let the loons through. Dinner fire till you can see the whites of their eyes. aim for their horses, and then close and give them the bayonet.
Later, George II, who had commanded the British forces in person, spoke to Sir Andrew about his role in the battle.
So, Sir Andrew, I hear you allowed the French into our lines.
Oh, I please your majesty. Will the dinner get out again?
Yes, quite. Good show, old chap.
Taken at face value, this source knocks the German Margrave out of the box in favor of the Scottish lord by 2 years. Almost all of these anecdotes are from received sources, and so it seems that we will never know with certainty who said the words, who said them first, or even if they were truly said at all at the Battle of Bunker Hill. At this point, one could hardly be blamed for tearing one's hair and asking if anything learned in school about the Battle of Bunker Hill can actually be depended upon, if the truth is not permanently obscured by a cloud of myth and folklore. It is comforting, then, to consider that the great impact of the Battle of Bunker Hill was to dispel myths and misconceptions about the American fighting man and to revise American prospects for victory in the Revolution. Ascribing American success in the battles of Lexington and Concord to unmanly fighting tactics such as, in the words of Thomas Gage, hiding behind walls and lurking in holes, the British did not have a great deal of respect for colonial militia. To the professional soldier of Britain, the militia were cowards, rascals, and vermin. James Murray of the 57th Regiment put it thusly.
During the last war, the Americans, those of New England in particular, were deservedly the contempt of our army, and still continue to act in a cowardly manner.
A restrained assessment compared to that of Lord Francis Rawdon Hastings.
Suppose the colonies do abound in men. What does that signify? They are raw, undisciplined, cowardly men. We shall soon have done with these scoundrels, for one only dirties one's fingers by meddling with them. I do not imagine they can possibly last out beyond this campaign.
A few weeks before the Battle of Bunker Hill, His Majesty's ship Cerberus was off Cape Ann on her way to Boston, carrying three of the major players who would take part in the battle, Redcoat Generals Henry Clinton, Thomas Gage, and Gentleman Johnny Burgoyne. In an incident that further illustrates the Redcoat's disdain for the rebels, General Burgoyne hailed the passing sloop HMS Otter for a few words.
Ahoy there! What news is there of Boston?
Besieged, sir! The country people turned out, 10,000 strong.
What? How many regulars are there in Boston?
5,000, sir.
10,000 peasants keep 5,000 king's troops shut up? Well, let us get in and we'll soon find elbow room.
After arrival, the strain of living under siege in Boston caused General Henry Clinton to consciously or unconsciously repeat Burgoyne's blithe prediction for pushing the rebels back and making some space.
Our elbows must be eased. An attack, a night attack, perhaps, ought to shake those poor wretches on the mainland.
And yet it was a different story after the attack took place. After three separate assaults on the redoubt atop Breed's Hill, the Redcoat vanguard succeeded in driving the colonials off the hill, but at a horrific cost. 1,054 British casualties, 226 dead, the greatest number of casualties that the Redcoats would suffer for the entire revolution in a single action, an account that included 100 officers. By battle's end, Lord Rawdon, wounded in the third assault on the redoubt, had been forced to considerably alter his opinion of the raw, undisciplined scoundrels he had faced.
The rebels rose up and poured in so heavy a fire upon us that the oldest officers say they never saw a sharper action.
Indeed, it was as if the entire army had experienced a cold awakening to the difficulties of the war they were about to fight, and the capabilities of the men they were about to fight it with.
This victory has cost us very dear indeed, as we have lost some of the best officers in the service, and a great number of private men. Nor do I see that we enjoy one solid benefit in return, or are likely to reap from it any one advantage whatever. We have indeed learned one melancholy truth, which is that the Americans, if they were equally well commanded, are full as good soldiers as ours, and, as it is, are very little inferior to us, even in discipline and steadiness of countenance.
Another Redcoat officer remembered the flames of Charlestown burned during the battle and the fury of the malicious defense, and bitterly recalled the overconfident predictions of Gentleman Johnny.
Figure to yourself the scene we saw, a constant cannonade and a large town around us in flames, a and above all a strong redoubt bravely stormed and almost as bravely defended. We have got a little elbow room, but I think we have paid too dearly for it.
General Thomas Gage, who would be replaced as the ranking British general by William Howe in the aftermath of the battle, couldn't conceal his distress.
The loss we have sustained is greater than we can bear. I wish this cursed place was burned.
Perhaps an Irish officer said it best and most succinctly.
We won the hill, to be sure. But to what gain? All we gained was a loss.
His black humor was echoed on the American side by General Nathaniel Greene.
I wish we could sell them another hill at the same price.
It's ironic to consider that the folklore and myth-making that have been attached to the Battle of Bunker Hill over the years is a direct result of the dispelling of myths that occurred that day. That the harsh truth administered by brave Americans atop Bunker Hill, or Breed's Hill if you prefer, has led to the light of romanticized heroism in which we see it today.
The Whites of Their Eyes was written by Sam Jones and relies heavily on The Decisive Day by Richard Ketchum and research posted by J.L. Bell on the Boston History blog. Part 2, an interview with Professor William Fowler. Professor Fowler, before we discuss the Battle of Bunker Hill, I was hoping you could explain how it is that American and British forces got to this point in the first place.
Well, listen, my children, and you shall hear the midnight ride of Paul Revere. And so on the 18th of April in 1775, word finally came that the regulars were on the march. Now, Boston had been expecting this for some time. It didn't come as a surprise. But on the 18th of April, Paul Revere was ordered by the Committee of Safety to ride out into the countryside, to warn the countryside, in particular the people at Concord and Lexington, that indeed the regulars were out tonight. The regulars were marching off to Lexington and to Concord in an attempt to intimidate, certainly, the resistance that had grown up in Boston during these very tumultuous years. They're also going out there to seize munitions, stores, muskets, gunpowder, cannon, that they knew from their spies had been collected there in the town of Concord. So it is Revere's task then, and he performs it very well, crossing over the Charles, landing in Charlestown, and riding into the countryside to alert people that the regulars are out. Well, by dawn on the morning of April 19th, Lexington militia had gathered there on Lexington Green to stand against the British. Their stand on the green, by the way, was not one to block the British advance. There were too few of them to do that, but really to stand there with Captain Parker in command as a symbolic gesture of resistance. Well, that gesture, of course, turned out to be and turned into a bloody moment in American history. The British soldiers advanced on the Lexington militia, fired on them, killed several of them, and then continued their march, the regulars, on to Concord to complete their mission, which was to seize the munitions. Of course, by this time now, late in the day, midday, and April 19th, indeed the word had gotten out across the entire countryside, the regulars were out, that there had been bloodshed at Lexington, and so swarms, thousands of American militia came down towards Concord and Lexington. The British began their retreat from Concord about midday, and as they began to retreat back to Boston, they were almost surrounded by American militia, chased them all the way back to the Charlestown Peninsula, and then the British crossed over from Charlestown back to the security of Boston. In the meantime, the American militia had followed them, but they didn't attack Boston. They stopped. And over the next few days, they surrounded the town of Boston from Hull down on the south side, all the way around to Winthrop. They entrenched themselves and laid siege to the town. In the meantime, while that was going on, the Massachusetts Provincial Congress collected numerous depositions and reports and sent them down to Philadelphia, because in Philadelphia, the Second Continental Congress was about to meet. The people of Massachusetts wanted to inform the men in Philadelphia of the terrible thing that had happened here and the outbreak of violence, and indeed, the beginning of the Revolution. The British, in the meantime, were trapped in Boston. There wasn't really much that they could do. Although they were safe and secure, they had the protection of the harbor, they had a strong naval force, so the Americans could not attack them by sea. In the meantime, the Americans themselves understood that there were at least two very strategic points nearby Boston that might help them, the Americans, drive the British from the town. These were two high points, one on the south side of the town called Dorchester Heights, and the other on the northwest side of the town, a place called Charlestown. At the time, to the north of Boston, on the Charlestown Peninsula, there were two hills, Breed's Hill and Bunker's Hill. The Americans decided that they would fortify Bunker's Hill, which was the hill closest to the mainland. The decision to fortify Bunker's Hill was made so that if it were necessary, the American forces could retreat back to Cambridge. There was another hill on the Charlestown Peninsula as well, which was further out and a little bit more exposed. That was Bunker's Hill. So on the evening of the 16th of June, 1775, an American force under the command of Colonel William Prescott marched out of Cambridge towards the Charlestown Peninsula with orders to fortify Bunker's Hill. It was dark, and there was apparently some confusion, but for reasons we've never fully understood, Prescott's and his men marched over Bunker's Hill and went further out onto the peninsula and fortified Breed's Hill. During the night, the 16th of June and early morning, 17th of June, they worked to erect an earthen fortification. Meanwhile, on the other side of the river, the British, although it was dark, they could hear the sound of picks and shovels. They knew that something was going on. When dawn arrived, they saw what had happened during the night, that the Americans had indeed fortified the top of this hill. The British could not allow the Americans to continue to have that hill because it did endanger their position in Boston. And so the decision was made that the British would cross the river and take the hill. On the morning of 17th of June, a British force began their trek across the river, landed at the foot of the hill in the town of Charlestown. And there they lined up in typical 18th century formation, these red lines, to march up and take the hill. They didn't think they were going to have much difficulty. After all, this was nothing but a rabble of farmers and plowmen. This was the best army in the world. The British were proud of their accomplishments, and indeed it was the best army in the world. And so the British soldiers began their march up Breed's Hill. As they came up the hill towards the American position, Colonel Prescott, moving behind the lines, is reported to have told his men, "Don't fire until you see the whites of their eyes." The Americans did hold their fire. Then, when the British were close enough, Colonel Prescott gave the command, and a volley of fire came down from the American militia. The British soldiers were stunned, shocked. They went down in windrows. Within a few minutes, the British were retreating back down the hill. They came back down to the hill, regrouped, and decided they would assault again. And so they went up for a second time. Again, the Americans held their fire till the British were within range, and then once again they let loose with a volley. And for a second time, the British scrambled back down the hill. This was now a matter of national honor that this American rabble had twice now thrown back the British. The British soldiers were told to put down their packs. They would go up just with bayonets and muskets. And so they began their third assault, this time with heavy reinforcements. The Americans in the fortification on the top of the hill had begun to run short of ammunition. As the British came close for a third time, the Americans were not able to respond with another volley. And so the British continued their advance, swept over the fortification, and did their deadly work in the American position. Most of the American casualties of that day were done by British bayonets. The Americans managed to retreat back down the hill, back to Cambridge. The British took Bunker's Hill, June 17, 1775. When they crowed about they had defeated the Americans, an American general from Rhode Island, a man by the name of Nathaniel Greene, responded, that he'd be perfectly willing to sell the British any other hill they wanted at the same price. For at the Battle of Bunker's Hill, misnamed to be sure because it was Breed's Hill, but at the Battle of Bunker's Hill, the British suffered the highest casualty rate of any battle that they engaged in the American Revolution. Killed, wounded, missing, more than 1,000 British soldiers. The battle at Bunker's Hill demonstrated that the American militia could, in fact, stand against British regulars, and it inspired others. And, of course, it would only be about 2 weeks later when a commander for the American Army would arrive in Cambridge, General George Washington. And when he arrived, he, of course, heard the stories, the tales, the reports of the brave stand of the American militia at the Battle of Bunker's Hill. That indeed helped to give him encouragement and faith that this ragtag army of American, New England, Yankee militia could be turned into a forceful army to secure American independence.
You mentioned just now that Americans did better than was expected of them, and that led the British to change their strategies. Could you talk a little bit about military strategy in the 18th century?
Military tactics on the battlefield, whether it's in the 18th century or the 21st century, are in great measure dictated by the weapons available to the men engaged. The primary weapon of soldiers in the 18th century, American and British, was the smoothbore musket. The British referred to their musket fondly as Brown Bess, named after Queen Elizabeth, and brown because the wooden stock was brown. These smoothbore muskets fired a solid lead ball of roughly 1 ounce in weight. This lead ball was fired through a complex mechanism in which a hammer flew forward, striking a spark that then went into a small pan of gunpowder. That spark into the gunpowder was then transferred into the barrel. An explosion in the barrel thrust this lead ball outward. Didn't have a very good range, maybe maximum effective range, about 100 yards. And it was a low muzzle velocity, which meant that the musket ball dropped dramatically once it left the barrel. The accurate range of a weapon like this was quite limited. And so the tactic then employed by armies in the 18th century using this weapon was to deliver a wall of lead. It wasn't accuracy that mattered so much. It was that everyone fire at the same time so that you send out thousands of lead musket balls at your enemy. And so distance was limited, accuracy was limited. That was true, of course, of the Americans who were equipped with the very same weapon. So advancing on a line, in step, one man right next to the other was very important because you wanted to be certain that when you fired, everyone fired together so that wall of lead would go forward. It was also very important that the men stay together because the principal weapon in a situation like this was not so much the firing of the musket, it was in fact the bayonet. That the tactic was that you fired first at your enemy, hoping to shock your enemy. You then continued the advance and attacked with your bayonets. Again, very important that everyone get to the same location together. You did not want to be a soldier 50 or 100 feet in advance of all of your peers. Everyone had to fire together with their musket, and everyone had to arrive together with their bayonets so that the full impact of all of those men would be felt at once. So the bayonet and the musket dictated tactics that the British used very properly. Their mistake, of course, in this case was arrogance. They should have been more wary of attacking a fortified position, but nonetheless they did, believing that the Americans were weak and would flee upon their advance. But the tactic they used at Bunker Hill was one that was fairly traditional in the 18th century, and quite frankly, often worked.
Who were some of the big military movers and shakers in this battle?
On the American side, the two most famous men present, certainly Colonel William Prescott. He was from Groton, Massachusetts, and commanded the troops. The man who stood behind the line telling them, "Don't fire until you see the whites of their eyes." Shortly before the battle, another American officer arrived, Major General Joseph Warren. Warren was a great American patriot, very famous, well-known physician in Boston. He had been among the very high Sons of Liberty, had given the famous Massacre Day oration, had written extensively and very well about American independence and the rights of Americans. General Warren showed up at the fortification. When he arrived, Colonel Prescott offered to give command to Joseph Warren, since he was the senior officer. Joseph Warren responded that that wasn't necessary. All he wanted was a musket to stand in line with the men, which he did. And there at the Battle of Bunker's Hill, Joseph Warren was killed. He was later identified, his body was identified, by Paul Revere through the set of false teeth that Revere had made for Joseph Warren. So Warren was indeed a famous, great patriot and one of the martyrs there at the Battle of Bunker's Hill. On the British side, of course, there were several senior officers, and some of them would see service throughout for a good portion of the American Revolution. The British officer in command at Bunker's Hill was General Sir William Howe, Billy Howe, as he was called. General Howe has often gotten a bad reputation, I think, and a bad press from American historians. He was a very capable officer, very distinguished officer. He and his brother, who was an admiral in the Royal Navy, would take great leadership positions during the war, and in fact were men who were moderate in their political opinions. There is a certain irony that General Howe would be in command of trying to suppress this revolution, when in fact General Howe was not unsympathetic to some of the American grievances. General Howe witnessed those two unsuccessful assaults by his soldiers, and as he stood with his staff there at the foot of Bunker's Hill, Breed's Hill, he witnessed the devastation being wreaked upon his men. And it's said also that many of the staff men standing next to him, many of his senior officers, were in fact wounded during that battle. The battle had an important emotional impact on General Howe. Also at the battle was Major John Pitcairn. Major Pitcairn was an officer in the Royal Marines. Major Pitcairn had been one of the officers in command during the march, the British march to Lexington and Concord. He was, by all accounts, a brave and able officer. Major Pitcairn died at the Battle of Bunker's Hill. He died in the arms of his son. So Major Pitcairn was, a brave and loyal officer. But I often think of the emotional impact on General Howe of watching this really amazing, stupendous threat of defeat of his soldiers, and how that must have impacted him, because he later went on to command the British Army in the early days of the American Revolution. And that command, during his command, people have observed that he often showed a bit of wariness, a bit of reluctance to engage the Americans. And some people suggest that reluctance, that wariness, was his concern that he not endure a second Bunker's Hill.
Now, the British won this battle, but the Americans seemed pretty pleased with the outcome. What was the value of the Battle of Bunker Hill to American forces?
The Americans were viewed by the British as a ragtag rabble, unable to defend themselves, and certainly unable to stand against the King's troops. We think of the battles of Lexington and Concord, and those were battles not in a typical European sense. Those were running battles, a series of skirmishes, really. It was also a time when the American militia greatly outnumbered the British troops there on the Battle Road. And so while the Americans had driven the British back to Boston, it was not seen as a great victory because it really had not been a typical battle. Wars in the 18th century were won or lost on the basis of 18th century tactics and strategy. And that's where the battle in Charlestown plays such an important role. Because this was not a time when Americans were running along the roadside in Lexington or Lincoln firing at the British. This is when Americans stood in line and looked directly at the British troops coming up the hill. And so this battle, and the Americans standing so firmly and fiercely and successfully against the King's troops, demonstrated that they could indeed win this war. So that was an important moment, This showed the British, and indeed showed the Americans too, that they could be a real army.
How did the Bunker Hill Monument come to be?
The monument is a magnificent monument. One of the first, by the way. One of the first, I'm always hesitant to say the first, but certainly one of the first battle monuments here in the United States. This great obelisk in the sky, granite obelisk, designed by Solomon Willard. The cornerstone of the monument was laid by the Marquis de Lafayette on the 50th anniversary of the battle, June 17th, 1825. Lafayette was making his farewell visit to America, and he was idolized everywhere. So this was a very great moment when he laid the cornerstone to commemorate this battle. It took a little bit longer, cost a little bit more, but finally the monument was finished some years later. At the completion of the monument, Daniel Webster gave the oration, and as was his style, Webster went on for about 2 hours, on and on and on about the symbolism of Bunker Hill, the magnificence of the monument, and the great heritage of the American Revolution. So this monument that towers over Boston today, part of the Boston National Historical Park, is indeed a great monument to the American Revolution and the men who died there in defense of American liberty.
Building the Bunker Hill Monument obviously suggests that we want to remember this battle. So what is the long-term significance of the Battle of Bunker Hill to America and its people?
The Battle of Bunker Hill gave Americans the confidence that we could fight. If we had not stood against the British at that battle, if we had not delivered such heavy casualties to them, we would have lost, at that moment, we would have lost the emotional vigor to engage in a revolution. It was that battle that energized us, that energized the American effort. Without that battle, we probably would have lingered. People would have lost enthusiasm. That battle really told the tale that Americans could stand against the British.
Professor Fowler, thanks so much for your time.
You're welcome. It's wonderful. I'm happy to do it.
Thank you for listening to the Freedom Trail podcast. Generous funding was provided by the Massachusetts Teachers Association. Learn more at massteacher.org. The Whites of Their Eyes was written and narrated by Sam Jones, creative director of the Freedom Trail Foundation, and was performed by the Freedom Trail players, John Overby, Nate Gundy, Chris Schultz, and Josh Rudy. Our guest today was William Fowler, distinguished professor of history at Northeastern University. Music was provided by the Middlesex County Volunteer Fifes and Drums. Learn and hear more at their website, mcvfifesanddrums.org. This podcast was created by the Freedom Trail Foundation. Visit us online at thefreedomtrail.org. Become a fan on Facebook and follow at The Freedom Trail on Twitter for This Day in History videos, updates on history, and other exclusive content. I'm your host, Matt Wilding. We'll be back next month for Massachusetts and Independence.